One of my favorite passages is in Luke 9:23, where Jesus says, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him take up his cross and deny himself daily." There's nothing that causes more misery in a believer's life than not denying yourself. And there's not anything that causes joy in your life more than the ability to deny yourself. I don't believe that there's one problem or one conflict that we have with other people that doesn't have this at its root: the lack of self-denial. And we talk a lot about self-denial, but rarely do we know what the self is that we're supposed to deny. So when we're commanded to take up the cross and deny ourselves, what does that mean to you? What are you supposed to deny? And what is a self-centered life? So I want to look tonight briefly at what the self-centered life is and what this life is that needs to be denied. If we look at 1 Thessalonians 5:23, Paul says that man has a spirit and a soul and a body. And I like to draw this like that. So we have a spirit, and those that worship God worship Him in spirit and in truth. That's the deepest part of your being. And then you have a soul, and in your soul is your mind, your will, and your emotions. And then, of course, all of that comes in an earth suit called the body. Now, God created you to meet His need because He loves you. 1 John 4:8 tells us that God is love. And He created you to meet His love, His need to love something. He wants you. And everyone in this room is valuable to God because He desires more than anything else to love you. And of course we know that that desire is awfully deep when He'll give His Son to get you. He wants to love you. And to make sure that you come to Him so His need is met, He puts in your spirit the desire to be loved. And with that, accepted. Now, I think that's ingenious. He puts in the deepest part of your being the desire to be loved. And the day you're born, you begin to search for God and try to find Him to meet your need. But in Genesis, we're told that Adam and Eve are warned that the day they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what would happen? They'd die. They went ahead and ate of the tree. They kept moving about in their bodies. They kept thinking and choosing and feeling. But God said they were dead. Where did the death take place? It took place in my spirit. So I'm born dead to God in the spirit. And it's impossible for me to get those deepest needs met. The needs that God created me to be met by Him. The desire for love. And what we begin to do at that point is look for others to meet that need. This love encompasses things such as assurance and security and acceptance and total commitment. Those are all spiritual needs that God intends to meet in me. But because we're born without God, we begin to look to others and try to milk those needs out of them. And I would like you to think of the last person that you were upset with. And the reason you were upset is because they did not give you assurance, security, their total commitment, their love, and their acceptance. And all that tells me is that you were looking in the right place or in the wrong place for the right thing. There is no conflict that does not have this at its root. And because we are created to be possessed by God and loved by God, we're driven to get that need met. We want that need met more than anything else. And we expect people to meet that need for us. If you've never found how God can meet that need, you may be trying to milk it out of the person you're dating or the person you're married to. And the day will come when you realize they can't meet that need, and in today's society, what do? When they can't meet that need? Yeah, you just bail out. And you go look somewhere else to try to get that need met. And you can continue through that cycle over and over and over again. So man is self-centered. Why? Because we want to get our deepest needs met that only God can meet. And I'm just going to take from you, and if you can meet those needs, fine, and if you don't, that's it for our relationship. We won't have anything to do with each other. Now, there's another problem, in that my mind, will, and emotions were created to be under the rule of God's Spirit. But if you're born dead to God in the Spirit, His Spirit is not ruling your mind, will, and emotions. So I use the example of an automobile. Cars are made for drivers. If you saw a car coming towards you with no driver, you got to get out of the way because it's out of control. Your mind, will, and emotions were created to be under the control and influence of the Spirit. And I'm not talking about being a robot. But if you're born dead to God in the Spirit, then His Spirit isn't ruling in your mind, will, and emotions. And you may ask, well, what's the significance of that? Sanity is having your mind, will, and emotions under the rule of God's Spirit. But if you're born without God ruling in your mind, will, and emotions, then what's your condition? Yeah, you're insane. And this just comes in different levels. All of us go around and you drive around in the car and you have this conversation with this person you don't like. And if they say this to you, you're going to say this back to them. And if they say that, well, you'll say this to them. And you have this little conversation as you go along in the car. Well, instead of having that in the car and thinking through it, just start verbalizing that at work and see what they do with you. Just start talking to that other person out loud and see what happens. Insanity is just a relative thing. You may see a car coming towards you totally out of control or going straight toward you, but if there's no driver in it, it's still out of control. The significance of that is that very few people ever judge their thoughts. And we won't have time to get into that, but I would ask the question, when you have a thought, is it God's thought? Is it your conscience? Is it your mind? Where did it come from? Is it Satan? And most people have never judged their thoughts. And I'll give you a secret tonight, that Satan always speaks to you in the first person singular with an Oklahoma accent. It'll sound just like your voice. And if you can't discern those voices, you'll end up following the wrong one. Yeah, they're easy to discern, and we'll talk about that later on. Now, look at my condition at birth. This is a bit pathetic. I'm born without any of my deepest needs met. I'm self-centered, and I'm striving to get them met. I'm also insane and not judging my thoughts. So in my insane, self-centered condition, I ask other people to please tell me who I am, who are also self-centered and insane. Does that make any sense? So I was in a mental institution. And I always have to clarify this. I was visiting. And I went up to talk to this fellow, and I said, I'm Mike Wells. And he says, you're not Mike Wells, you're a rabbit. Now, if I start hopping, who's crazier, me or him? Pretty hard to tell, right? But you begin to ask, who am I? Would you please tell me who I am? And you received from people around you identity messages. For example, for a girl, you may be asking your father who you are, but he never does tell you that you look pretty. He never puts you on his lap. He never holds you. He's never pleased with anything you do. No matter how much you do, you need to do a little bit more. No matter how far you go up the ladder, he seems to be able to extend it a little bit, and you need to do more. That gives you a message about yourself. And you begin to wonder if you have any worth. And for us fellas, if we've never been able to get our dads to sit down and talk to us, and yet every time the phone rings, they'll talk to those people, then what's that tell you? That those people are more valuable than you. We receive a variety of identity messages. What if you've been sexually abused? What kind of message does that give you? Now, I want you to know that Satan has your history, and he has one thing in mind for you, and that is to steal, kill, and destroy. And he thumbs through your history, and he reads it, and he sees in there that you've been abused. And he can't wait until the right opportunity to stand behind you and whisper, I am worthless. He'll never say you are. He'll say, I am worthless. And since we don't judge those thoughts, we begin to receive that as our identity. Now, I want to show you how identity really affects us. And it's one of the core issues in our life. If you would, for me, draw a couple of circles on your paper. And in the first circle, we just put the impression that we want to leave a room full of people. So this weekend, you're going to meet some people that you haven't met before. And let's just assume that during the break, you go out and talk to them for a while. What would you like them to say about you? What's the one thing you'd really like to hear them say? Or maybe there's several things you'd like to have them say about you. Most of us would like probably to be smart. Doesn't hurt any to be attractive. We want to be kind and caring. We would like to be spiritual. Now, if I take that kind of a person that leaves that kind of impression to a slave auction, how much money will I get? If I say we're going to auction them off, let me describe them first. They're kind, they're smart, they're attractive, they're spiritual. What would I get? Quite a bit. Because all of that says that this person has worth. Now, here's the depressing thought. What I am at my worst moment is my true condition. How would you describe yourself when the whole world's caving in, your boyfriend, girlfriend just dumped you, you found out that your third year as a freshman is really going to be rough, you're not all that happy about it, how would you describe yourself then? When you're laying in bed at night, what do you say about yourself? Well, I feel like a failure. I was stupid for ever dating him. I'm unacceptable. And how do you girls feel when you look in the mirror? Okay. You feel ugly. Alright. And so if we take this person to the slave auction and we say, we're going to auction them off, but first of all, I need to tell you they're a failure, they're stupid, they're unacceptable and ugly. Let's open the bidding. Well, that says that you're worthless. Now, we won't have time to talk about it tonight, but we've received several identity messages that have told us that. There are things that happen early on because we're looking for an identity. We don't know who we are because we're born without Christ. And we've received these messages, and we've come to believe that this is what we are. And in some ways, our actions are now even begin to confirm that that is what I am. Now, who's going to want to date this mess right here? Nobody. So if any of you have this kind of stuff in your circle and you got a date, be thankful. Nobody wants to date this. So what do you have to do to get a date? You got to put on your success suit. And you got to run to the sewing machine and make this success suit and put it on and zip it up as high as you can so nobody can see this. And you're in a bit of a fix because this is how your relationship has to be. Come here because I would sure like to milk love and acceptance out of you, but stay away because I'm afraid if you get too close, you're going to begin to see this and you'll reject me and that'll prove what I've always felt I am. It'll just be another identity message. You with me on that? Now, in that condition, we're always controlled. And people control us by telling us what we want to hear on the positive, and they control us by telling us this in the negative. Isn't it interesting that Jesus, in that room, before he's betrayed, we're told that he knew where he came from, he knew who he was, he knew where he was going, and he knew the hearts of the men in the room. And yet he could grab a towel and wash their feet because circumstance and events did not affect who he was. You with me on that? He didn't live by every little circumstance and every little event. And the self-centered person lives out of that. You better watch your words around them. You better not say anything that offends them. You better not say anything that hurts their feelings because you'll pay for it. And yet Jesus was free because circumstance and events didn't say anything about himself. It just said something about the people around him. And what it said to him was, I need to give my life for them to get them out of this condition. So we have to cover up what we feel we are. Now, let me show you how that controls us. If any of you have noticed, my artwork hasn't improved any since last year. If we put in this circle a problem, and we'll just say that the problem is that this person is always withdrawing and hiding from others. Under stress and pressure, they just withdraw and they disappear and you can't find them. So the problem is that they withdraw. There's several ways we can help a person who withdraws. We can buy them a beer and get rid of all the inhibition, and then they'll be talking and laughing it up. Is that a good plan? We might give them some medication. Well, one group's on. I'm going back up. The medication won't help. There's several things we could do with that problem. But what I want to know is, why do you have that problem? Why do you withdraw? And we look over here, and there's an event that caused you to do that. And someone looked at you funny. Now, here's a subjective and an objective person. If you're going down the street and you see your best friend and they're on the phone, your best friend just called home to check on their mother. And when they called home, the ambulance driver answered and said, "We're running your mother to the hospital. She's having a heart attack." Your friend is in shock. They just wanted to see if mom needed some bread and how she was doing, and they find out they're headed to the hospital with her. So as your friend hangs up the phone, they just come walking down the street in complete shock. And they just stare through you because they can't see you. They're in turmoil. And they go past you. The objective person says, "What's wrong with them?" The subjective person says, "Oh no, what did I do to her? I wonder if she found out what I said. I wonder if this, I wonder what I did," on and on and on. It's taking the blame, seeing it through your own emotional filter and accepting blame. So that can be a tragic event for one person and not for another. So two of us could be together and this person stares through us and I think, "What's wrong with them?" And you're thinking, "What did I do?" So this event affected you and you get depressed and angry about it and you withdraw. But here's the next question. Why do these events affect you so? Why is it that most Christians are not free people? I was speaking at a church recently, and I made the comment when they were discussing what could our church be known for in the community. And so they're going for family, and maybe we could be known as a family outreach and a singles ministry and all these different things. What could our church be known as? And my suggestion was that it would be known throughout the city as the church where the people could not be offended. Wouldn't that be a beautiful place? To make that as your goal. A fellowship where the people cannot be offended. Why is it everyone is so easily offended? Why do events control us and manipulate us and move us and steal life from us every day? Why do they make me withdraw or get drunk or whatever the problem is? And what you'll find is that whenever an event takes place that undresses you and rips away your success suit and reveals this, you get mad and this is how you cope with it. So whenever an event takes place that proves you're the very thing you've been working so hard not to be, you'll get mad and cope with it in some way. So I use this as an example. It's not a very good one. You may have to think about it for a while. But imagine that I have a bunch of soldiers come in here right now and they make all of you take off your clothes and you got to go home naked. And you don't have a choice. Every one of you in here is going to lose your clothes or get shot, and you got to go home that way. How do you handle that? Well, some people may just get drunk, and then it's just nice not to have them. This wasn't such a bad evening after all. Now, some people may decide to hide, and they've already got their course plotted out of this room. They're going to hide behind that, behind that, behind that, behind that, behind that, and they'll be out of there. Other people will just get enraged about it, and they'll scream and yell at you so you won't look at them. And then there's the person who is what I would do. Well, I just never deserve no clothes anyway. I was lucky I had them as long as I did. And I'm sure looking forward to the day when I get some more. You just get depressed about it. Well, I just knew all this was going to happen to me. Whenever an event takes place that strips away your success and leaves you standing there naked feeling like this, you've got to have a way to cope. You might run to the refrigerator. You might run to the movie. You may read a book. You might even go out and preach and teach. People go out and get drunk. People go out and take drugs because their identity is so painful, they've got to find something that'll cover it up. And again, we want to be careful in how we judge people in the way they cope with their pain. Because if you knew the pain that some people went through, you would know why they were taking cocaine as fast as they could get it. Because they've got to find something that'll cover that and hide it. All of these mechanisms that I use to cope with being undressed are called, in the biblical term, idols. An idol is anything I run to other than God under stress and pressure. And Jonah 2:8 says, those that cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that would have been theirs. They've found some way to cope. And we as believers, when we're undressed and these things are revealed, we have a tendency to run to the idols of the past. Those idols were formed before you knew Christ, and some of them are formed after. But they're things that we've developed that allow us to cope with being undressed. And some of them look real good, and some of them look real bad. And all that is, and all that says to me is that when it comes to idols, there's bad, bad idols, and there's good, bad idols, but they're all idols. They're all ways to cope with this pressure. Now, when you live in this condition, you'll always be controlled by events. You'll always be saving yourself. You'll always be trying to structure events so they prove what you would like to be. And you can become a real controller, bringing everything in line so it fits. Now, what's the solution to that condition? What do we do with it? Well, again, we've said getting rid of the problems probably won't help because you'll just find a new way to cope. And there's plenty of counselors you can go to that all they do is tell you that the little idol you have doesn't work and we'll switch it with a new one. See, yelling at my wife doesn't work anymore. So the counselor says, don't do that anymore. We'll put you in a room, Mike, and just put a mattress in that room and go in and hit it whenever you're frustrated. There's a lot of that kind of thing that goes on. We can end up switching idols, but I don't think that's going to help. There are a good number of people that will tell you to change your circumstances. So you spend your whole life running. And you're always looking for the great Christian someday when everything's going to be different and it'll all change. And I could save you a lot of time and money by just telling you that you can run, and when you finally get settled, you'll find that you drug this along with you. That you brought it along also. That it didn't do any good at all. So it doesn't do any good to work on events. But if we could kill the past, that made all this up, and this is my past right here, the identity messages and the received identity. If we could kill it and give you a new past that had worth, and true value, and true acceptance, then the event wouldn't bother you, you wouldn't have to get angry, and you wouldn't have to run to your idol. So one of the things we always want to look at are the root issues. Now, let's look at that another way. We have another one of these, Scott. Thanks. We'll draw a model of man a little differently, one that comes out of 1 Corinthians when Paul talks about our inner and outer life. This is my man. I might have told some of you, I was in Argentina lecturing to some medical students, and I drew my little man out, and somebody said something in Spanish, and everyone was laughing. So I asked the translator, I said, what did that guy just say? And he said, oh, he just said he was glad God didn't give you the job of creating men. Well, I don't think we'd all look that bad. But all of us have an outer life, and we also have an inner life. And those two lives together, the outer life and the inner life, make up you. That's what you are. If your inner life were to die, you'd fall over dead. If your outer life were to die, you'd fall over dead. Both of those make you up. Now, we're all human, but there are 5 billion different forms that this human life takes because it's unique to each individual. So we're all human, but there are 5 billion different forms of outer life. But if we could get the inner life to step out of a person, we would see two races. You would either see Adam's life or Christ's life, one of those two lives. And we're all born with Adam's life. And yet, Adam's life also takes on its own unique characteristics and form. The first thing that we know about having Adam life is that it hates God's commands. And yet, Paul tells us that in his mind, he could love the commands. Now, if in your mind you love them, but down here you hate them, what's that causing you? You have plenty of conflict. So how many times have you gone to seminars or conferences and the speaker has got up and told you wonderful stories about their life and what they've done, and you begin to compare yourself to that, and they tell you how long they pray and how often they witness and how their witnessing always works out and how their prayer life is always answered, and it sounds so good to you that you decide to give it a try yourself? How long does it last? Well, if those things worked, the whole world would be a different place, right? We hear that, but we can't do it. We have knowledge, but we don't seem to have the power, and that creates more conflict in me. I'd like to do it, but I can't do it. That sound like anybody you know? Paul says that. He talks about that struggle. And read Romans 7 and 8. We want to do it, but we can't. Scott and I have a friend from India who, when he was at one of our mountaintop retreats, prayed through the night several times. And he's a beautiful brother. And when he's at my home, and he'll stay at a month, 6 weeks at a time, he'll get up every morning at 3 and pray till we go to work at 8. Well, after I observed that for about a week, what do you think I decided to do? Get up at 3 and pray. I got up at 3 the first morning, 4 the second, 6 the third morning, and I slept in until we weren't going to work Friday. I couldn't take it anymore. It all sounded good, but I couldn't do it. Now, not only do we have a life in us that we're born with that hates God's commands, but this life begins to be formed in the womb of the world through the events that take place, through the identity messages. And this little thing in the world called the unholy trinity, sin and the world and Satan, makes plans to attack us and to develop this inner life. And he takes whatever resources he has. So if you have an alcoholic father, and you notice that your father loves the bottle more than he loves you, and you notice that he doesn't have time for you, but he has time for the bottle, then he begins to whisper to you in that voice, I'm worthless. I'm unacceptable. Just what do I have to do to get this man's attention? What do I have to do? And no matter how hard you work, it's never enough. And pretty soon, you begin to be frustrated and disturbed over the whole thing. And you decide that the best way to cope with being disturbed and frustrated is to go drink yourself. And what does that do to your identity? Well, it proves that you are worthless. Now the enemy's even got more ammunition to tempt you. He uses the things that take place around you to control you through this inner life and to shape it. And eventually a person does begin to feel worthless, unacceptable. Often the enemy will use an event such as adoption. If you were adopted, to whisper into your ear what? I was unwanted. And the rejection that we can have, if you had a parent who is overprotective, and every time you got the screwdriver out to fix something, your dad yanked it out of your hand and said, let me do it. What's he telling you in that? What if you girls, every time that you had to make your bed, you walked by the corner of the room and mom's redoing it the right way? Well, you can usually tell women have been treated that way because you can need a snow shovel to get from the front door to the back because they just give up. Says they're stupid. They can't do that right. So this identity begins to develop. And as I said before, from the three circles, we're now controlled by it. And the enemy uses any event to prove that to me. So if you have a person who was always loved by their father, for example, a woman, and he took the time to tell her she was valuable and attractive and pretty, when her boyfriend drops her, it's not as traumatic as it is for the girl who's never felt attractive and was trying to hang on to this guy with both hands and her claws in him, because she's trying to get him to disprove what Dad always told her. So it's a lot more traumatic. Now, when you recognize this in yourself, and you know what you are at your worst, and you begin to see that it controls you, what's the one word that comes into your mind? We want to change. Do any of you want to be that way? So let's imagine that we begin to see that this is what we are, and we have several ways of coping with that. Some are pleasant and some are very unpleasant. I recently was discipling a couple, and the way she coped with feeling like this is every morning she got up and put on a porcupine suit, and nobody wanted to touch her. And she's a pastor's wife, and it was fun to watch the way the women in the church related to her, because they'd walk up to her like this and asked if she was coming to the meeting. They were scared to death of her. She kept everybody away. And the way he coped with feeling this way is he put on his nice guy suit every day and zipped it up. Everybody thought he was wonderful, but he couldn't stay there very long because they might find this out. When we see this is what we are, imagine that I take you to the hospital and I say, I want you to cut this person open and get their inner life out of them and let me work on it. Does any surgeon have a knife sharp enough to do that? Could they even find it? So one of the things we want to discern always in our Christian life, and we'll make progress if we'll do this, we don't discern what works. We can still make progress if we can discern what isn't working. What are the things that you've tried to change this within, these feelings within that you have? And so there's a lot of things we've tried. People try counseling. You can try popularity to try to change it. You might even pray to try and change it. And what you're praying is, Lord, help me improve this. Help me improve this condition. So we may pray, help me not to be this way anymore. You can work harder at it. You might read your Bible. There's thousands of things that you can try to do that. And it's interesting to me, and we'll just say this as an aside, that in the garden was a tree, and that tree was called the tree of good and evil. And we often do evil when we're tired of trying to change this condition, and we rebel, or we turn to good to try to change it. But I want you to notice that good and evil are on the same tree. And often what we hear in Christianity is this: you did bad, now you need to do good. I was in an evangelistic open-air meeting not too long ago, and the evangelist gave a tremendous message, and he asked people to come forward. And as soon as they came forward, he says, "Now, let me tell you what you need to do. You were doing bad, now I'll give you the good to do." Another way to draw this tree, and you've all seen this little symbol for Taoism, spelled with a T. And if you put a little trunk on that, you have that same tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's a lot of Christian teaching that's just Taoism. That's all it is. In fact, I enjoyed this. One of the fellows in China was a Taoist teacher, and he became a Christian. And within 6 weeks, he was sought after all over China to teach. So he was asked, "How did you get to be such a sought-after Christian teacher? How can you grow that fast in 6 weeks? And he said, "Well, really, it's easy. I was teaching Taoism before, and now I just teach Taoism in a Christian format. Instead of doing bad, you need to start doing good." So what kind of good things have we tried to change this? And maybe even bad things. It can take some time, but eventually you'll come to a point of despair. And you'll say, "I just can't do it." Now at that point, you've said the two most precious words the Lord will ever hear come out of your mouth: "I can't." Do you realize that if you could, He would have never sent His Son and you could have been the Savior? It takes a lot of effort and a lot of work to come to the point where you can say, "I can't. I just can't change myself." And at that point, I'm ready for God's solution. And we find it in Galatians 2:20. He never intended you to change yourself. He always intended to exchange yourself. He doesn't want to improve this life, but instead He wants to replace it with His life. "I've been crucified with Christ, and it's no longer I who live, but Christ that lives in me." Colossians 3:4. When Christ, who is our life. Now let me show you the significance of this. Here's your outer man, and you're born with this inner life, and it's all distorted. And here's your outer life again, doesn't look any different. But the day you gave your life to Christ, you didn't get something, you became something. A new creature. If any man be in Christ, what is he? A new creature. Now, we'll talk about experience later. That's going to be the rest of the conference. You may not experience being a new creature, but you've got to see what you are before you'll ever experience it. When He, the day you came to Christ and you asked Christ into your life, He exchanged this life for His life. Read Romans 6. He gave you a new life. You may look the same, but you are not the same. Now let me share some of the advantages of living that kind of a life. When you were conceived, what did your parents give you? Well, if they'd have died an hour before you were conceived, you'd have showed up missing. So what did they have to have in order for you to be conceived? They had to have life. And whose life did they give you? Well, it's their life. But now who owns it? You do. But it's still their life, but it's still yours. So a good analogy is a guy with a heart transplant. Whose heart does he have? Well, it's Joe's, but it's mine, but it's Joe's, but it's mine, but it's Joe's. When you're born again, whose life do you get? Whose life comes into you? Okay. Now who owns it? Colossians 3:4. When Christ, who is what? Our life. Who owns it now? It's His life, but who else owns it? You do. It's your very life. Christ is our life. It's Christ in you, the hope of glory. He's given you a completely new life. Now, here's the significance of that. And when you catch on to this, your Christian life will never be the same again. Is Christ's life completely acceptable to God? Is there anything He needs to do to be more acceptable? Is Christ your life? Are you acceptable to God? Do you need to do anything else to be acceptable? Then you can spend your life working not to get God's acceptance, but working because you are. See the difference? Is Christ's life near to the Father? Is Christ your life? Are you near to the Father? Can you get any closer to Him than you are right now? You know, people never find the nearness of God because they don't know they've always had it. They're seeking for something they've always had. If any of you leave this room to go find me, you just lost me because this is where I'm at. If you go searching for the nearness of God, you lose it because you always had it in here. Now, do you read your Bible and pray to get near to God, or do you read your Bible and pray because you are near to God? One is law, the other is grace. Here's a tricky one, and Galatians will give you all the information you need on what law does to you and what law does to a believer. Is Christ's life holy? Is Christ your life? Then are you holy? I'm not talking about your actions. I'm talking about who you are. You are. Now, that's why God punishes you when you act unholy. His punishment is not to make you holy. You're getting punished because you are holy. I don't punish my children to make them my children. I discipline those children because they are my children. You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Are you or are you not? He says that you are. And it makes all the difference in the world. Because the enemy will tell you, whenever you're being holy, you're a hypocrite because you're not holy. And God will say to you, whenever you're acting unholy, you're a hypocrite because you are holy. It's all the difference in the world. I'm not working any longer, and I'm working harder than I ever worked, but I'm not working to get God's acceptance. I'm not working to get near to Him. I'm not working to improve a condition. I have a life in me that has everything I need. And in my prayer time every morning, I ask to be heard on the basis of this life in me, not my actions. And that's a wonderful experience. And it'll be proven on your worst day when everything's gone rotten, you've failed, you've acted very unholy. Can you stand with boldness, as we're commanded to have in Hebrews, before the Father, requesting, knowing that you'll get it, not because of your behavior, but the life in you has earned it, and it opens your heart wide to praise and to joy. There's a fellow, just a story I like to tell, that I met in a female impersonator bar. And I got to just say, I was in there witnessing. This fellow, when he gave his life to the Lord, I told him, go home and put on men's clothes. I gave him a commandment. Go put on men's clothes. Did I give him the command to change what he was or to reveal what he was? To reveal. In all of Paul's letters, he tells you who you are before he ever tells you what to do. But if you try to do the doing without understanding who you are, all that doing is do-do. Because it'll never work. But if the doing comes out of who you are, then it's life-giving and it's freeing and the commandments are no longer a burden. It says, we said of the Ten Commandments, when you see those in this light, that the life in me has kept those Ten Commandments, I don't see thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh my, I better make sure this never happens. I better run this way. I better watch out. Instead, I see it as a promise. I will never commit adultery. The Beatitudes are a beautiful thing to read when you realize the life in you has kept every one of those commands. And you don't have to work to change any longer, but you can work to reveal what you are. Accepting Christ is not just getting something, it's becoming something you never were before. And now your deepest and truest identity is in Him. He's all that matters. And since the outer life and inner life makes up me, if I exchange one, I'm a new me. Therefore, what I did, I never did. See, one of the proofs of being a new creature in Christ is that when you remember any things you did before you were a Christian, they put kind of a pit in your stomach. That's because the new you would never do it. And what happened to you never happened to you. Now, this person here might have been molested, but I promise you this one never was. You're a new creature. And that's a beautiful thing. You get a new beginning. And no one can continue to hold you accountable for failure. Now, one question I had by a girl said that, well, I'm a believer and I've been raped since I was a Christian. So I can't say that the new me's never been raped. But the beauty of finding our identity in the Spirit and becoming a spiritual person and looking to Him is that the life in her was never violated. And as you draw near to that life, you'll find that that has much more power than whatever happened to your physical body. I've known men in third world countries who have preached and been thrown in prison for their preaching and raped repeatedly while they were in there, and they came out strong believers because they said, no matter what they did to my body, they never touched the deepest me. They'll never do it. They'll never get the job done. Because what's true of him is true of me. And we accept one another not because of our actions, but because of the life that's in us. Now, let's take about a, 15-minute break? And we'll come back and go at it again. Hope you don't feel like you're drinking out of a fire hydrant. Let's just look at a couple other aspects. If it's true that this jellyfish has a man in it, if it's true that I have Christ's life in me, why is it that I still experience some of the old things? If Christ's life is my life and His life is not angry, why do I get angry if He's really my life? If Christ's life is free from lust and I've got Christ in my life, how come I'm lusting? If Christ's life is free from gossip and I find myself gossiping, why is that? How can that be? And I want to look at that briefly. When the old man was in charge, all of his coping mechanisms, all of his idols were registered in the mind. And when you come to Christ, your mind isn't erased. Some of us would like that to happen. My wife thinks my mind has been erased. But most of us still retain some of the old things. The ways we've learned how to cope. If you'll remember that Israel got out of Egypt by looking up to God and saying, we can't. There's no way for us to get out of here. So God did miracles, and they were brought out by God. And yet when they got to the borders of the Promised Land, they looked within and were told in Ezekiel 8 that they were still carrying their idols with them. chapter 8 and chapter 20. And they kept those idols. And God said, you can't go into the promised land with idols. And it wasn't until they laid them down that they could enter into the promised land. And so you see Christians who come to Christ saying, I can't save myself. I can't keep myself out of hell. So they accept Christ, and then they try to live the Christian life with their old idols, and they live in misery. Now, all of those idols are registered in my mind. They're still there. I remember the things that I used to cope with other than Christ. So all the baggage remains in my brain. The example of that would be if you've ever had anyone close to you die, and you go into their room and see their things, it stirs up your emotions even though they're gone. The person may be gone, but their baggage still can stir you up. And even though the old life is crucified, as we're told in Romans 6 and Galatians 2:20, the Christ life comes in, but the baggage remains up here. Now, the enemy hasn't gone anywhere. And he continues to devise temptation. But he can never overcome this new life in you because Christ defeated him on the cross. So what he tries to get you to do is shut off Christ's life, close the door, and I just call it an abiding door. What opens this door and allows Christ's life to flow through you is humility. If there's one word that describes God, it's love, but the one word that describes Jesus is humility. He's divine humility. And humility is not saying, I am nothing, because he said he was the Son of God. But humility says, I have nothing. I can't. So he emptied himself and he took the form of a man. And he didn't walk in independence. He only walked in what God told him. In fact, the New Testament doesn't record any original sayings by him because he says, I only spoke what God told me. And so as he walked in humility, he was always saying, I can't. I can't handle it. And saying I can't opens the door to Christ's life. And you'll see the people who have that door open, you'll notice them because you'll see the fruit of the Spirit. And whatever they do, the love, the joy, the peace, the patience, all of that will be there. And what closes the door is saying, I can. And as soon as you close it, then those people are obvious by the deeds of the flesh. Frustration, anger, worry, doubt, fear, anxiety, depression, the door's closed. So here's how it works. Lord, I can't handle my roommate. Door swings open. And what they get from you is a dose of Christ. And you know what changes your roommate? Not conflict, but contrast. The Indian that stays with me could have came in and said, Mike, I've noticed you don't pray enough and started condemning me, and I would have had him out of there. But because he never said that and the door was open, the contrast between his life and my life was such that I couldn't take it. It is contrast that changes the world around us, not conflict. It's not a good argument that changes people. But it'll always be that contrast. And as you open the door and they see the difference in your life, it'll begin to have an impact and it'll be leaven. Lord, I can't handle my roommate. I can't make them keep it as clean as I like it. But if you don't change them by Friday, Lord, I'll fix them. There'll be peanut butter under the pillow. All the junk they've left around, I've been saving. And then they'll find you coping the same way you would have as an unbeliever. So you can see an unbeliever that's vindictive because the enemy was working through the Adam life. But when you close that door to Christ's life, the enemy does an end run and he stirs up the baggage and your roommate will think they're living with an unbeliever. Now that happens to all of us, and what it ought to tell us, and let's just say that here I have peace, and before the way I coped is anger. And I'd yell at people and get them out of my way. Now I'm a Christian, the door's shut, and I find myself angry again. What's the problem? Is the problem my anger? No, the problem's that the door's shut. Now, we'll talk about this later, but the enemy loves to have you fight the battle where the battle isn't. You can say, please fix my anger, but your anger isn't your problem, it's this. And we'll talk about this later on tomorrow. There isn't anything that the nearness of Jesus doesn't cure. But you're not allowing Him to flow through you. So, whenever I see my anger, the old ways I used to cope, it's a flashing red light that tells me what? I've closed the door. And you can open and close it as fast as a thought. It's that simple. You know, there are a lot of people who would love to know or have some way of knowing or discerning when they're getting off track. And when this pops up in me, I know I'm getting off track. It's a warning to me that the door is closing. Now, the next question is, why would God make me that way? He takes away the old life that the enemy used to control. He gives me a new life, Christ's life. But He leaves the baggage here so I can be just as miserable as I ever was before. Why would He do that? And here's the reason. We started out and said that God desires to love you 365 days out of the year, 24 hours out of every day, 60 minutes out of every hour, 60 seconds out of every minute, and He desires to love you moment by moment. Now, all of us have that one little sin in our life, whatever it is, and our thinking goes like this. If we were just free from that one sin, we'd really be able to serve God and press on, right? Just that one little thing, if it would just go away, this thing that keeps vexing me. How many days out of the year would you like to be free from that one little thing? How many hours out of the day would you like to be free from that memory of that horrible thing in the past? How many minutes out of every hour? How many seconds? How many moments? Well, it looks to me like God has a need, and you have a need, and both of you can do business now. Here's the rub when it comes to Christianity. There is no one-time fix. So stop looking for it. The one-time fix came the day you accepted Christ, and He took that old life out of you, and He put Christ's life into you. But from now on, there is no one-time fix. There is not a day in the future when things are going to change and get better. There is only now, this present moment. God desires to love you moment by moment. So He leaves this stuff in you, so you have to go to Him moment by moment. And His need is met, and your need is met. Now, He only leaves it because He loves you. And the more garbage you have, the more potential you have to stay near to Him. And then often, the person who's the most hurt and had the most turmoil will stay nearest to God. He who is forgiven little loves little, and he is forgiven much what? Loves much. These things drive you to God moment by moment. Now, as you open that door, you'll find yourself free. Now, just try this sometime. When you're struggling with any sin in your life, whatever it is, that one thing that has a hold of you, when you're struggling with some thought of the past, go get before the Lord Jesus in a quiet place and open your heart to Him and turn your eyes to Him. And the Hebrew word there, or the Greek word in the book of Hebrews, consider. That's an interesting term. It was used by astronomers, and the first astronomers were shepherds. And a shepherd would go out and lay on his back all night protecting the sheep, and he didn't have anything to do, so he would consider the stars. It means to gaze at them for a prolonged period and discern from what you see. Now, that's incredible. In Hebrews chapter 3, He's warning these people throughout the book of Hebrews that they're going to fall away. Whatever falling away means there, it's bad. We can agree on that. But he says they're going to do that, and their solution is to consider Jesus. It's an astronomer's term. Go out and just gaze at Him. And whatever your problem is, you gaze at Jesus and you'll come into divine sanity. You'll see hope that you never saw before. You'll find deliverance in that moment from whatever the sin or the problem or the thought was. Now, if that's the case, and God only sets you free when you come to Him in the moment, then is that sin in your life Satan's stronghold to make you unproductive, or is it God's stronghold to keep you near so you'll be ultimately productive? If this thing in your life He only frees you from when you draw near and open the door and say, I can't, and His life is able to flow through you to others and change the world through contrast, is that problem and sin Satan's stronghold or God's? It's God's. See, that one thing you've been wanting Him to get rid of and take away is the only assurance He's got you'll ever amount to anything. Because He'll set you free from that when you draw near to Him and His life flows through you. I was talking to a fellow who was tempted in homosexuality, and I said, when are you free from it? And he said, I tried what you told me, and I'm free every time I'm near Him. Then I said, do you see how blessed you are? That God has got something that strong in your life to keep you that close to Him? The Lord really wants you. It's not a curse, it's a blessing. All that matters to God is this moment. The analogy I use is when Israel went out in the wilderness and they collected manna. And if they got enough for 2 days, what happened to it? Turned to worm. Jesus says in John 6, He's the true manna that came down out of heaven. Jesus you had yesterday is worms today. What happened 10 moments ago doesn't matter. What happens is this moment. He didn't redeem you for some point in time where He could enjoy you for 15 minutes or for 15 months. He wants you moment by moment. If I say to my wife, come in here and come to bed with me, and she says, why would we do that? We did that 16 years ago. What do you think I'm going to say? So what? I don't care what happened 16 years ago. I want you now. And the Lord doesn't just want to draw you near once and then be happy with it. He wants to draw you near moment by moment. And you can see that all the bad in your life in His hands always becomes good. He can change everything that's bad into something good. If all that matters to God is the moment, and right now it's 8:08, all that matters is that at 8:08, you've got the door open. Now, the enemy knows that, and he wants to steal then the moment from you. That's all he cares about stealing. And the way he steals the moment is he makes you worry about the past or worry about the future. And as you do that, as you remember your past failures and the things that happened and on and on and on, as you live out of the past, this moment is stolen from you. As you worry about what's going to happen Monday when you get back to class, 8:08 is being stolen from you. And we can reverse this and say that moments turn into seconds and seconds into minutes and minutes into hours and hours into days. And I know people who have lost all of this. And it just started with a moment. Just the moment being stolen from them. Now, let's look at another practical way of opening the door. And we're about ready to quit this. We said there's two types of inner life, either Adam's life or Christ's life. Adam's life was created, it had a beginning, but it never has an end. So Adam was a created being and he has no end. All of these lines represent lives all the way down to yours. And here's where you're born. This is your mother here. And let's ask the question, where were you when your mother was 3 years old? Anybody want to guess? If your mother would have died when she was 3, you wouldn't be here, right? Where were you when she was 3? You were in her. In fact, it's a medical fact that a baby girl is born with all the eggs she'll ever have. They're not fully develops, that she's born with all she'll ever have. So where was the egg that was going to make you when your mom was three? In her. So when she died, who else died? It's a miracle that any of you are here tonight, because in the year 700 B.C., if your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother would have died in that plague at age three, you wouldn't be here. That's amazing, isn't it? So where were you when Adam and Eve were in the garden? You were in them. And when they fell and were cut off from God, they passed that on to you. So you're born with a life cut off from God. That's Adam's life. The other life we talked about is Christ's life. And Christ's life, one of the terms that's used, he's called the Good Shepherd, the Son of God, the Son of Man. But one term that's used for him is the eternal life. Read 1 John. He is the eternal life. And that life has no beginning and it has no end. He can be anywhere at any time. So Christ was with God from the beginning. He came into the earth. He was crucified, buried, and raised, and seated with heaven, and is still with God. He has a life that has no beginning and no end. So if people ask you, do you have eternal life? You say, yes, because I have Christ's life in me, and his life will never end. That gives a lot of confidence, because you can never be cut off from God. Because Christ can never be cut off from God. He secured that for you. And I always like to mention this, but if you've ever wondered if you were saved, that's proof that you're saved. So remember that. If you've ever questioned if you were saved or not, that is proof you are saved. Because an unsaved person never questions if they're saved. That deception only works on a saved person. Satan can only whisper that to somebody who is. And it's a sure sign of salvation. I counsel about half the people I see are unbelievers, and I haven't had one yet come into me and say, gee, I was wondering if I was saved. It just doesn't happen. The enemy never tempts an unbeliever with that kind of thought. They know they're not. They're children of wrath, and they know that. And the only reason you would possibly worry about it is because you are. So if that ever happens, you have eternal life. His life has no beginning and no end, and Romans 6 tells us that we were put into Christ. So the day you accepted Christ, you were brought into him. Now remember, wherever your ancestors were, that's where you were, all the way up to Adam. Now, wherever Christ is, where are you? You're with him. Where was he when the world was created? He was there. And we're told, you who he foreknew from the foundations of the world, as soon as you were in him, he's known you from the foundations of the world. You've always been there. So where were you the day Christ was crucified? You were in him. So who else died that day? You did, and that old life that you've been working so hard to change was put to death. And it was done away with there. Now, most people never experienced that truth because they were never shared that truth. But I have been crucified with Christ. And we don't experience it because even though our old man has been put to death, we've never had a burial. Now, it goes something like this. Imagine that 10 years ago, or let's just say 5 years ago, you came to school as a freshman. For UK State students, that might have been 10 years ago. Listen, I'm a K-State graduate. I'm just having fun. I knew you'd all take that real well. Let's imagine that 5 years ago, you were rooming with somebody that really helped you out a lot. In fact, they're the only friend that you had. They're your best friend. And you got up one morning 5 years ago and looked over in the bed and your roommate's dead. But it's the best friend you ever had. So you hate to bury him, so you prop him up and tape their arms to a wheelchair and you take them with you everywhere you go. Now, since they're your best friend, when you wheel them up to the lunch line, nobody better say anything bad about them, even though you know they're rotting and stinking. Now, that was 5 years ago, and they've gone beyond rotting and stinking. And you're still taking them around, and it's just skin over bone now. But everywhere you go, you take it, you protect it, and you can't figure out why no one wants to go out on a date with you and have a little threesome. They just don't like this thing. But it's all you ever had, and you have to push it around everywhere you go, and you've got to protect it, and you quit combing the hair because there's none left. Now, the wisest thing you could do is have a burial. Would you just admit that it's dead and that it stinks and that it's rotten? And that's what your old life is like. It died whenever you came to Christ, but did you have the burial yet? Have you accepted the fact that the judgment of death was on it, that it deserved to die, that it was ugly, that it was unacceptable, that it was rejected by God? And just have the burial. And now, you know what happens? You get a new life, but this life is real life. And instead of pushing it around in a wheelchair, it carries you everywhere you go. And it whispers in your ear, "You're acceptable. You're my child. You're loved." Every word that he whispers stirs joy and excitement. And now when you go to the lunch line and the people make fun of that life, instead of getting mad and trying to protect it, you feel sorry for those that make fun of it. And you begin to pull them up, because if they only had what you had, if they could only be carried the way you're carried, they would know the joy that you know, and you have compassion on them. You see the difference? Live out of the old life that's dead, protect it, and you become a stench to everyone around you. Live out of his life, and you'll always be a fragrant aroma. People will love that smell. Now, when we started out, we said we want to take up the cross and deny ourselves. We know what that self is that needed to die. We want to have the burial. And now we want to have the daily cross to deal with the baggage of that old life. Those old thoughts, those old feelings. Now, we'll make it a little bit practical. When Jesus said that to the disciples, they knew exactly what he meant. The Romans made people carry their own cross through the city as a proof that they had received the judgment they deserved. So as you carried your own cross through the city, you were saying to everyone who saw you, "I agree with the Romans, this is what I should have got." It's interesting that Christ didn't carry his cross. They put it on a man, they got out of the crowd, and Jesus walked, then the man and the whole crowd. Who was worthy of death that day? The crowd. And when he got to the cross, after spending all that time with his disciples, there was only one person that caught on. Everybody there said, "You ought to die so we can live. We're glad that you're dying," and they're all shouting. And as long as they got to save themselves, like old Peter, it was all okay. "You're my best friend and all this, and it's causing me a lot of misery to see it happen, but it's not as much misery as I'd have if I lost my life." There was only one man that caught on. And it wasn't one of the 12, and it wasn't one of the 3, and it wasn't John. But it was the thief on the cross who said, "What are you doing here? I should die, but you ought to live." And remember Jesus' comment to him? What was his promise? "This day you'll be with me in paradise." You caught on. Now see, everybody wants to save themselves, and we never want to do that as a believer. It's interesting that the Romans would take a person, and they would drive a spike. They would bend your legs a little bit. You're probably familiar with this. They would drive a spike through the ball of your feet. And what kills you in crucifixion is that you suffocate. So what you could do, if you had a strong enough will, is push down on that hole through the ball of your feet, and through intense pain, you could raise yourself up enough to take one breath, so you could continue your pain. Does that sound a bit insane? That's the self-willed believer. They refuse to accept the death sentence on self-life. And through their strong will, they push down and they cause pain and they create pain, and the only thing they do is maintain their pain. So you live in your bitterness, you live in your anger, you live in hostility, you live in your idolatry. It causes you pain and it allows your pain to continue. And that's why a soldier would watch this for a couple of days and say, "I really pity this fellow." And he would go over and break his legs. But Christ accepted the cross as coming from the Father. He didn't live in self-will. He came to do His will. And they didn't need to break his legs because he didn't play that kind of game. "God, you put me here, and I accept death." And he gave up his spirit. Now, if you're living the self-centered life, give it up. Give up your spirit. You'll find life as you lose. And that's the principle of the cross. They yelled up at him and they said he saved others, but he couldn't save himself. If he would have saved himself, everyone here would have lost life. But since he lost his life, everyone here gained life. That's the principle of the cross. To the degree you'll lose, to that degree you'll give life to everyone around you. My best example of that is when I was in Bible college. Some of you heard this. And I'd gone home, and my wife, when I walked in the kitchen, said something really rude to me. And so I decided to punish her by going back to the bedroom and not talking to her. And as I've said, I've since learned she enjoys that, so I got to switch tactics. But I go back, and I'm going to punish her by not talking to her. Who does she think she is to talk to me that way? I don't have to take that. Nobody has to take that. If I take that, I'll be encouraging it. She'll keep going on and on and on. And I just sat down to study, and I slammed the door real good so she would know I was upset. And then I started studying for my exam, Ephesians 5, "Husbands, love your wives." And I immediately started searching for why you shouldn't. Because she didn't deserve that. She didn't deserve that kind of love. And if I go in there and love her, she'll do this again to me. And I don't have to take it. Maybe after I punish her and she pays for it, I'll start loving her again. And then I waited and waited, and the Lord kept putting pressure on me. And finally, I said, "All right, I'm going to go out there and tell her I love her and kiss her." And I headed out there. And I have to be honest about this. To this day, I don't think she deserved it. But I went out there and went wading out there with these concrete boots. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, with her back to me. And I spun her around and said, "I love you." And I gave her a kiss. The hardest thing I've ever done. And you know what she said? "Well, I'm glad you finally stopped acting so stupid." And I sat there and I just about came unglued. Going all that way, and then she sticks the knife in and twists it. And I don't know why I did this, other than it was God teaching me a lesson through His power. But I reached forward and I kissed her again and told her I loved her. And she turned around and kept doing the dishes. I can't explain what happened that day, other than to say it was like a tree broke inside me. And it's the first time in my Christian life that I'd experienced losing my life, that I had experienced denying myself. And I won't know how much I gained until I get in heaven and find out how that little event shaped me. And of course, we know successful Christianity is made up of little events. The little victories always make the man or the woman of God. Look for the smallest thing. There are a lot of people who can do big things for God, but they can't do that one little thing. And as you begin to lose your life, you'll be so excited at the power you have in the little bitty thing. And life for you will no longer be in some big task for God. You'll judge success by this little bitty thing. Can you lay down your life for the people around you? And if you lose your life, you'll spread life. We were sharing in a staff meeting, a friend of mine, Scott and I, this guy is a man's man. I mean, he's everything a man ought to be. I really like this guy. He's rough, he's ready, he's knowledgeable. He lives in a 6,000 square foot log cabin that he built himself. You know, it's covered with trophies in it, the bears and all this kind of stuff. He knows how to do everything. And talk about a guy that's tough. He is tough. He fell off of a four-story building, got up and drove himself to the hospital. He was kayaking in Canada, and he fell out of the canoe and was under the ice for over 2 hours swimming out to find a hole. And he's just that calm. He just went for it and breathed the air as he found the pockets and came on out. Well, they'd never find me until winter. I'd be up against the thing. There's Mike. We found him. When he was building his log cabin, he was cutting these logs and the chainsaw kicked back and cut his face completely, split it open. Knocked out all his teeth, cut his jaw in two and his nose. And you know what he did? Took off his shirt and shoved it in that hole in his face and drove to the doctor. This guy is tough. He's sitting there telling me about a mountain lion that he's just killed that killed four of his dogs. And he got all done with all that, and I said, "You are a sissy." And I thought he was going to hit me. I said, "You tell me all those things you've done, but when it comes to denying yourself and loving your wife and overlooking the little rude thing she said to you, you are so petty and so weak that you had to move out of your own house. You're a sissy." Because true strength is not judged in big things. It is judged in the smallest thing of life. That is true power. And I said to him, "I can say to you with all confidence, I'm twice the man you are. Because I lay down my life in the little things." And it's amazing how the strongest men in the world cave in when it comes to this little thing of not holding a grudge against your wife and not allowing a root of bitterness to begin to grow against the people around you because they said something about your old man in the wheelchair. It's pretty hard to sort out. But that is the true test of a man or a woman in Christ. I never want the big things. I just want to win in those little things. And today and tomorrow, sometime, you'll have an opportunity to win. You'll have an opportunity to take up the cross and deny yourself. And don't miss it. Don't let it pass you by. We're to become the compost pile of the world. Let them throw all their garbage your way and beautiful flowers will continue to grow out of it. Never reject it. And know that whenever the garbage is being thrown your way, it's for one purpose, and that's a greater release of the life within you. So never, never reject those kind of tests. And one thing about the Lord's test is if you fail it, you get to take it again later. And some people have been in the same course, taking the same test for a long, long time.